My name's Scott. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Scott.
Hi, guys. I'd like to thank John for asking me down to speak, and I'd like to thank the committee and the convention for showing my wife and I such remarkable hospitality. I'd like to thank the first speaker. Can I see the hands of people in the first 30 days? Wow. How about hands of the people in there? That's great. Hands of people in their first year, first 12 months. Wow! Wow! Well, this has been a great meeting for me, and if I didn't get to speak, it would have been all right. I got to take a new man on as sponsor right before the meeting started, and I got to just have a word with my sponsor and a friend of mine, and we were we're over on the side, and I'm looking at these two guys. So I'm I love my sponsor. He's my friend and my sponsor, and this other buddy of mine is a dear friend of mine. And how did we wind up here? One of these guys was a Skid Row bum, and then sober, he got to run the LA Marathon through Skid Row, through the Nickel where he used to hang out. And my sponsor, fashion plate that he is, was trying to figure out how to cut his throat below the tie line so he'd look good at his funeral. I think I'll tell his story today, as a matter of fact. How do we wind up here? If you're new here, if you're in that first year, if you're anything like me, you're looking around the room at some of us wearing our ears today, and you're saying, Alcoholics Anonymous. How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? This is beyond lame. This is lamer than synagogue, lamer than church. This is a plateau of lameness I didn't even think was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. You're with the lame-os now, man. And we're good at it. We're the best. There ain't no one lamer than us. I tell the men I sponsor, you think you're lame, man, but you ain't got nothing on me yet. I was pleased and amazed to be asked to speak at a young people's meeting. The men I sponsor are getting a lot of mileage out of this. Asking me why I've been asked to speak at a young people's meeting, but they'll pay for it. They'll pay for it. I'd like to thank my wife for coming here and hanging out with me and being a part of my life. My wife, Nancy, who used to accept me for what I was, which was a punishment from God, and that's changed a lot. One more thing I would like to mention is my friend Phil R.'s parents are here from London, England, to be with their kid, and I'd like to welcome them. Why don't you guys stand up? Mr. and Mrs. Rowland. My wife won't stand because she's too humble, and she just won't do it. Whoa! Not. If you're new here, and you're anything like me, you're just delighted to hear that you're beyond human help. You know, in our seventh chapter, which is a horribly sadistic document, if you ever get a chance, give it a look. It's called Working with Others, and it says, get a man while he's down. I'm going to tell you the secret now, if you're new. We're going to tell you, and then we're going to do it to you anyway. Get a man while he's down, crushed up, really creamed, coming off a bender, hurting really big time. Get him to laugh with you, get him to cry with you, you know, share the strange mental twist that precedes the first drink exactly as it's done in the third chapter, the chapter on alcoholism. And once you get him to laugh with you and cry with you, then heap upon him evidence as to the hopelessness of his situation. Always good news for the new man. And then stress this. You know, some people say, you know, don't talk about God. You'll scare that new guy away. But, you know, the book says stress the spiritual angle freely. I mean, what could you guys do to me when I got here that hadn't been done already? You know, I mean, what? God, I mean, I just figured I'd find a way to do it without that God nonsense, and I'd move on. My journey to Alcoholics Anonymous was a horrible one. It took me quite a long time to get here. I was brought up through a completely insane family in the Bronx. I share about this every time I share. I mean nuts. I mean, my wife never believed me about my family until my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my aunt wore her wig backwards, and it had a bun on it. And and it wasn't a mistake. It was a look she was going after. It was she knew it. She knew it. It just was. It was kind of a natty feel to it, and she liked that. And I had one. Anything my family got for free, man, it was stolen. And I had an uncle who was a welder, who got free steel wool, bales of steel wool. And my aunt took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled them all with the free steel wool. So when you were in their house, everybody would be in a little motion, because that stuff works its way through on you, and they'd have a little English on them, you know. My grandmother had to be watched while bathing to make sure she didn't kill herself. My aunt was chronically, people were in and out of mental institutions all the time. Absolutely, completely insane. And that had absolutely nothing to do with making me an alcoholic. Lots of people have difficult wives and families. They don't shoot a quarter grain of heroin in their hip when they get anxious. I do. If you're special and a drug addict, I'd like you to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You might want to stick around long enough to get alcoholism. We have a treatment for that. When I came in here, I was a dope fiend and a writer and a director. You didn't have a book for that, so I had to wait around long enough to have alcoholism. I don't mean to offend anybody, but that was kind of my deal. My deal was I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and then shot heroin till I didn't want to be a heroin addict, and took pills till I didn't want to be pills, and I conquered pills with marijuana, and I triumphed over marijuana with cocaine. And cocaine's a difficult drug. It's good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. good for sincerity too. It's a sincerity and budget. Good budget drug. But if you have alcoholism, if you're new here and you have alcoholism, all I've got is good news, man. We have a treatment for alcoholism. We don't have a treatment for that other stuff. I was in psychotherapy for 18 years before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on the brink of being a very well-analyzed corpse by the time I got here. And it's very confusing. I was doing great work in therapy. Unfortunately, I was dying. I'm not putting therapy down. It's great stuff. Book says on 133, if you need a doctor, go get one. Sounds pretty clear to me. I think if you're going to go to therapy, you might want to go to one who understands alcoholism. It's kind of like going to a doctor for a broken leg and have him going, geez, I've always wanted to see one of those. Well, what do you do with that? Let's look it up. But as a treatment for alcoholism, it was worse than useless. I thought I was getting something accomplished. But I was on this horrible treadmill. I was going to be dead with no Oedipal conflict. You know, I was going to be dead with no body phobias. I was going to be very dead and very healthy. And it's very confusing, because I was doing great work in therapy. But again, this sickness of the soul, it was absolutely useless. If you're new here, you could have alcoholism. You could. If a certain kind of thinking has become established in you that has placed you beyond human help. If you've been getting drunk at exactly the wrong time. If you've been building up a bright outlook for yourself and your family and ripping it down around your ears in a senseless series of sprees. If you fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, a second ago, and repeat the same insane behavior over and over again. If you get excited when you're told you need dental surgery. Boy, they don't laugh at that one at the Rotary, folks, I'll tell you that. Guess I'm at an AA meeting. If you have spent any amount of time protecting your right to vomit. Normal people will do anything to not vomit. They'll go to any length. They will certainly not lie, cheat, and steal to get a drug that will make them vomit. And if it's good, it'll make them vomit right away. That's like going home, coming home with a bag of stuff from Vons and taking a bite, vomiting, saying, honey, get the kids, this is good, you'll vomit, it's great. In our book, in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth says that the alcoholic life will become the only normal one. And I did not know from a very early age that I had rearranged my life to accommodate alcoholism. I didn't know it. I didn't even know I had alcoholism. I know what I had. But I didn't know it, and I had rearranged everything. My outlook towards life, my feelings about art, politics, my feelings about you, about religion, about spirituality, about everything. I was introduced to a Old Testament God. I was raised in a middle-class Jewish home and taught that Jews don't drink because it might dull the pain. And I was introduced to an Old Testament God that I wouldn't be caught in a dark alley with. This guy got you. He got your butt, man, no matter what. He hunted your butt down and he got you. And he turned your wife to salt and put a finger in your eye and killed your goat, man, and he got you. No matter what. I was a hip, slick, and cool kid growing up in the Bronx. And you had to speak a foreign language to talk to God. And my Hebrew name was Shlomo. Now, I don't mean to offend anybody. There might be some Shlomos out there today. I wanted to get a Shlomoectomy immediately. I wanted out of Shlomo fast. I wanted to go steal cars with my buddies. We didn't even steal them for profit. The first speaker made a dollar, I think. We used to steal cars and smash them into each other. I mean, this is the kind of rocket scientists I was hanging out with. We'd have demo derbies, you know? Unbelievable, these guys. It was them. It was the group I was hanging out with, but you know that already. And my father thought, my father was a bartender. He never made more than $10,000 a year. He thought he was a real loser, and I completely agreed with him. I thought he was a sap and a sucker and a yo-yo. And my father never made more than $10,000 a year, and my brother and I never went to school with ripped clothing, and we never missed a meal. My last year out there, I made $80,000. My children did go to school with ripped clothing, and they did miss meals. How had my father become a loser? Because a certain kind of thinking had become established in me that had placed me beyond human help. I had some very lofty goals as a young man, and by the time I got sober, I had reached or surpassed them all. By the time I got sober, I had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a movie. I directed a film, I directed a TV show, I had my own theater in New York, assistant artistic director of a theater, and I had done all these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once, because they'd move the business after I'd left. And people were just horrible to me, terribly, terribly mean to me. And when I took the X-ray of my illness, it's the only X-ray, the only picture of alcoholism I know of, which is our fourth step. You know, it's funny because sometimes I talk to guys and they're working on their inventory and they say, "Geez, you know, can't I just come over and do a piece of it?" And I try to discourage them from doing that. I try to let them know, you know, the guys who wrote that book, what a cagey bunch of guys. Besides putting the ninth step, the promises in the middle of the ninth step, which is the biggest trick they played on us, I think, ever. They knew, I think, that if we did the whole inventory, if we took a look at the whole thing, that we would see the crushing magnitude of this illness. And that unless you saw the whole thing, if you didn't see it that way, that you were trading off this once in a lifetime opportunity to experience that deflation of ego at depth and see the monumental wall that you have constructed that you are running your head into. And when I took a look at that, I was sharing with somebody earlier, my sponsor, who's a very loving and gentle man. When I went to get the instructions in a fourth step from him at his house, he allowed me, I felt there were some things he needed to know about AA before I let him show me this. And he let me explain the program to him before he gave me the instructions. And he knew I was like a boated fish, that it was my last flop on the deck there, my last chance to be an authority before he showed me this stuff. And at any rate, when I got a chance to take a look at that picture of my illness, I saw that early on people were doing things behind my back. A little later on, they started talking behind my back, and in the last years, they started thinking behind my back. And that, as you well know, is a horrible thing. It's terrible when they do that. It's hard to catch them. but as everyone here knows, you can. You got to just accuse them of it enough times, and you'll make it so. If they're not thinking of you, you'll make it so. That son of a gun accuses me of this one more time. I'm going to wait till he falls asleep and set the bed on fire. That's right. A little later on, I was in the middle of triumphing over alcohol with heroin, and my father had a heart attack, and I was picked up and taken to the hospital. He had a massive stroke, and I was loaded the night he died, and I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that I had done this. I was standing there with holes in my arms, loaded. I couldn't be there for my father. The sound of the heart machine couldn't get through because the curtain was down. I couldn't be there for my mom. I couldn't be there for my brother. I felt like a pig, a misguided miscreant, some kind of animal. And I swore I'd never put a needle on my arm again. And I didn't. For 13 years. I stayed in therapy, drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, smoked pot till I didn't want to be a pothead. And this obsession of the mind, coupled with this horrible allergy to the body, because you see, when I take a drink, I go down to the middle of my bone, you know, the part that produces red blood cells. Normal people don't do that when they take a drink of alcohol. Normal people's drink doesn't go boom. My drink goes boom. And because I had to rearrange my life to attend to my alcoholism, I developed this horrible sickness of the soul. And newcomers, it's a real bizarre thing, and we're going to ask you to stick around. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it later, but we're going to ask you to stick around and try to take a look at that sickness of the soul, because it seems without addressing that sickness, it doesn't matter what we do physically, it doesn't matter what we do psychologically, we simply will not get better. Wife or no wife, job or no job, money or no money, we simply will not get well unless we start to find this power that seems to save the lives of alcoholics. Sometime after this, I met my wife, a remarkable woman, a beautiful woman, an intelligent woman, who, if you had written everything I had done in 8 years of marriage down in a book and given it to her and said, would you live with this? She'd say, no, who would live with this? But spread it out over 8 years, throw in a best-selling book, throw in some bouquets of flowers, throw in chronic success, throw in the fact that I was always going to take the walk to the drink, and over here, often I was telling the truth. It got murky over here, and it was quite often an out-and-out lie by the time I got to the drink, but quite often it was the truth over here. You know? Yeah, you'd live with it. It'll chip away at you. It'll make you crazy, selfish, dishonest, self-centered, and self-seeking. And we became very, very ill together. We had two children who became terribly sick from the disease of alcoholism. Fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. The fabric of our lives is shot through with it. And how horribly true for the young people who are exposed to this illness. Because nothing ever winds up the way it's supposed to wind up. Nothing ever comes true. The rug is constantly pulled out. When you live in a psychological theme park, anything can happen. Dad comes home, he looks like someone's been experimenting on him. He looks like he's walked out of the GM wind tunnel. Every part of his face is moving in a different direction. What's up? And we had these 32-ounce tumblers in the house, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine one night. I dumped the whole bottle of wine in this glass, and I looked up, and Nancy was looking at me like this. I said, what? She said, what are you doing? And completely straight, I said, I'm having a glass of wine. Can a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We became very, very sick. And our children became very, very sick. And one night I put my arm around my wife. I was going to bed, and she felt my accelerated heartbeat. And under her voice, she said, "You disgust me." And I didn't argue it because I knew that it was true. I knew that I disgusted her, and I knew that I disgusted me. And I knew that my life kept running out between my fingers like a handful of water over and over and over again. And I just didn't get it. Finally, sometime after this, after all the careers were gone and the money was gone, our last landlord turned to us and said, "If you move, I'll lie for you." "I'll write anything in a letter if you move." I was seeing a therapist. It wound up being a Jungian therapist. The first time I had ever seen a Jungian therapist. This is only important because it's an important part of our book. Because the man who 12-stepped the man who 12-stepped the man who was the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous seems that he was in therapy with Carl Jung. And Carl Jung told this man, after he tried to psychoanalyze him and bring about a spiritual rearrangement in the guy, and the guy, it failed and the guy drank, Jung told this man there was absolutely nothing that could be done for him. And one morning, after I had put a needle in my arm again, I had crossed the line, I swore I'd never cross again, I called my therapist that morning, and he said, "There's absolutely nothing that can be done for you." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Look, there's nothing I can do for you." I mean, thank God this man had this kind of humility. He could have said, "Come on up and we'll talk about it. I don't think I'd be here." But he didn't. He threw his hands up. He said, "There's nothing I can do. The only thing I can suggest is that you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized." And on most other mornings, I would have gladly chosen the institution. It would have been a chance to spend some time with, you know, some more adventurous and creative people, the kinds of people who I was used to associating with. And instead, I went to that AA meeting. I don't know why. I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning to attend a 7 a.m. meeting, put on my best clothes, got a bad check to write you, and went down ready to pee in the cup and get on the mailing list and do the deal here. Now, I don't know if you've been to 7 a.m. meetings, people are just hanging on by a thread, you know. Most of them have their underwear on the outside of their clothing, and I'm there ready to report to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nuttier than a fruitcake. You know when a newcomer looks like an outtake from Scanners, you know? The veins on their head are like garden hoses, you know? They look like a breeder reactor. They leave a trail of light when they walk, you know? Wow, that's where I was, man. God, and I walked in there, and I thought everybody had one tooth and it had a cavity in it, you know? They're all wearing belt buckles large enough to serve a whole fish on, you know? And there I am in the deep valley, man, ready to get better. And if you're new here, I hope you're out of plans. Because if you have one, it's probably a Lulu. Man, it's probably a Hummer. It's grab one of us after the meeting and share that plan. We want to hear all about it. But I hope you're out of them. I hope you're out. I was out of plans that morning. I don't know why I stuck around. I certainly didn't stick around because of the steps. I wouldn't have known a step if it had bit me on the face. If you're new here, you are now privy to an unending and unsolicited reservoir of advice and information. And if you're like me, the kind of bully I am, my first shot is nice guy. I'm a sterling human being. I'm a hell of a nice guy. And that's how I've bullied people to get them to do. And our book's real clear. It's just sometimes we're gracious, sometimes we're obnoxious. It's all about the same thing. Sometimes we do both together. I've never been big on that. But I'm a nice guy, so I came in, you know, and people would talk to me, and I'd grin and nod my head and pray that their face would burst into flame, that they would just... I mean, I'm here, man. Isn't it bad enough that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous? Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, my God. I'm a major guy, and I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not believe it. Couldn't believe it. So I stuck around for about 6 months. I thought I had worked the first three steps. Our book says the third step will have little permanent or lasting effect unless followed by a fourth. I hadn't done that. So I guess the third's going to kind of come and go. So I worked the first two. I admitted I was an alcoholic. That's a fatal illness. My life is unmanageable. And that I needed to be restored to sanity. Not that I would be or was, but that I needed to be. So I had admitted I was dying, my life was a mess, and I was out of my mind. How come I didn't feel any better? Why should I have felt any better? I hadn't done anything. I hadn't used this plan for moral psychology. You know? The second step says, come to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Not would, not should, that it's possible. If lack of power is my dilemma, if my only hope for survival is this spiritual experience, if I've placed myself beyond human help, and that spiritual experience is promised in that 12th step, then I guess all step two is an admission of possibility, and now let's move forward and do this work. You know, people are so frightened of the fourth, and yet in our book, in Newcomers, if you do an inventory, it says you've just made a good beginning. You've digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. You've made a good beginning. You know, and then five is, chapter six is called Into Action. We have a bookie friend of ours who's had a kind of a tough time sobering up, and he thought Into Action meant something else and never never read it. My sponsor's been trying to get the guy to read the thing. He goes, I know about that. So I asked this guy to sponsor me, and I knew this guy had been a bad guy. You know you can tell when they've been a bad guy. You know, you see those little antelopes and bunny rabbits hopping around in their eyes, you know? And I knew this guy had been a bad guy, and he was bigger than me, which I liked that, you know, that he could take me, you know, if it came to blows. And he had I just watched him. I watched him real carefully, and he talked about God, and he didn't sound like a sap to me, you know. And I asked him to sponsor me, and all hell broke loose. I came over that night. He let me explain the program to him, and we sat down, and he showed me that work. And, you know, I wrote a resentment about something, and I was writing a defect of character list, and, you know, this is the stuff in me I'd like God to take away. And he made some suggestions, as he's wont to do at times, if he feels that I haven't seen all the defects. And he said, liar. What? Now, I had lied to everyone about everything all the time. I had lied to keep conversations going. I had lied. I mean, my brother said, you're wearing my pants. I said, no. I had lied to and I couldn't, when I had to write that on a defective character list, I said, couldn't we put dishonest? That's a little more civilized, right? Liar. So I did my fourth and fifth. I did my sixth and seventh. Came time to do my eighth step list. Best reading of the eighth step I've ever heard in my life. And if you're new here, that's our beginning of our amends step. And if you're anything like me, the purest reading of it I've ever heard was a guy at my home group, which is the Monday Night Men's Stag in North Hollywood, who had never read chapter 5 before. And he had a heavy New York accent. He had never seen the material before. His name was Nino. Never seen the guy again. And he was reading chapter 5, and he got up to step 8, and he said, made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out in the crowd as if to go, have you guys seen this? Do you know what's... I mean, it was so... It was so pure, because that's where I don't know how about you, but I went, oh, no, not that money, not those people. Are you out of your mind? How can I do that? It was... So if you're new here, it's 8 steps away from where you are. Don't worry about it. And it's the 9th you got to worry about, really. But try that one with your sponsor. Well, I don't want to make amends yet. I'm still working the 8th. Yeah, that usually goes over real big. And I said, geez, you know, I don't want, what am I going to put my dad down here for? He's dead. There's nothing I can do about that. And my sponsor said, well, I'll tell you what, you owe him an amends. I said, absolutely. He said, you put him on the list. You put him on your list, and you do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you see what happens. Now, I had fancied myself a show business big shot before I got in here. Of course, the old timers are real impressed with that. I started doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started working, and shortly after I got sober, I got a real good job on a catering truck and cooking for a living. Funny thing was, it was a Teamsters job, so because it was on movie set, so it actually was a lot of dough. I mean, I needed to be grateful for. I mean, it was, you know. It was pretty remarkable that I got it, but I'm there. My first movie that I cater, the star and executive producer was a guy who I had worked with in the business. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning and he said, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I turned and said, what's happening, man? Oh, my God. He said, well, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. I'll tell you that. I couldn't believe it, man. I got home. I called my sponsor. I said, you won't believe this. The kitchen truck and this and God and no. And he said, well, I tell you, you're probably going to have to sit down and write a 10th step. I think you've got some resentments here. I got to sit down. I'm resentful. It's Scott for being on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A little knock in the crotch there, a little ego blow. Five-bagger there. That's a five-bagger. But to admit that that people are wrong was as far as most of us ever got. We've got to go further. What is it in you, Scott? What poison in you that if God would remove right now, would the resentment be gone? Blue skies, God's got a magic wand, he comes down, touches you on the head. What is it in you? If it was gone right now, this horrible tapeworm would be away from your soul. Well, I'm ungrateful, I got a job. A lot of guys who are sober up don't even get to work. I'm a people pleaser, I care more about how I look than the fact that I can work. I have false pride, I have low self-esteem. I'm not trusting in God. If I trusted in God, I'd know that things were the way they were supposed to be. I'm playing in God. People aren't following the Scott Redmond program, a Sterling program. I'm unwilling to accept the fact that I am a child of God who is spiritually ill, because if I could accept my own spiritual illness, I could show myself the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And I'm impatient because things just aren't moving along like they should. And I'm ashamed. I'm resentful at that guy. Why? For being alive and wanting a burrito. I mean, why? I mean, the guy hadn't done. He didn't do anything. He wasn't mean to me, but I was resentful at him for seeing me on the kitchen truck. What are the defects? Another five bagger, believe me. And what are the defects? I'm ashamed. I'm a people pleaser. I'm grandiose. How could a man of my caliber possibly wind up on a kitchen truck? Again, not trusting in God and getting the impatience. And I had to write a resentment against God for putting me on that kitchen chair. And my sponsor said, you got to go in 6 and 7 and you can ask God for some relief. And that's what you've got to do. Because that third step, turning my will and my life over to the care of God, that confused me. I said, God, I'm yours. And he said, oh, thanks. I'm God, by the way, and I knew that. I'm God, it's my deal. I had a feeling you were mine, but I appreciate it. Really nice of you. But when I said, Father, take this poison, what can I do, Father? What can I do to get some relief? And I can't work the 7th step and say, take it, you son of a bitch. And I can't say, take it, if you can, big guy. Take it! Please, take it! I can't do it anymore. And that's when that 7th and that 3rd step really started becoming concrete and real and alive in my life. A relationship is a two-way street. My wife and I don't work on our relationship anymore because my idea of working on a relationship is to talk to you until you change your mind. It is... is to talk to you until your eyes roll back in your head and you keel over and on the way down you go, okay. I had to have a relationship, and this was my relationship with God. Sometime after this, I got a job that could have gotten me out of the ghetto, you know, the ghetto that I thought I was living in. It was a big comedy writing job, you know, and gosh, it would have been great. And I obsessed on it and crashed and burned before I even heard about the job. I was so nuts about this. And I did my 10th step. I was already resentful at them for not giving me the job because of my mind reading skills. You know, I mean, I had, and I called my sponsor, I worked my 6th and 7th step, I got free, and then I got a call that I didn't get the job, and I was okay with it. I got a call to, and it was for Larry's Public Relations, was the company. And I got a call to go up to Lake Arrowhead and cater a commercial. I go up there, I get the call sheet, and who's the commercial for? Larry's Public Relations. I can't believe it. Not only is it for Larry's Public Relations, but they're taping the making of the commercial. So now they're going to go to New York with the tape, and they're going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf there? What? Isn't that the guy we just turned down for that other job? That poor guy. I call my sponsor, well, it makes his day. He's laughing his brains out. Made his week, right? He said, well, I guess God had enough directors and he needed a few cooks. I said, well, I guess God had enough idiots and needed a few sponsors. I said this to myself. Believe me, I did. And a couple of years before I got sober, my wife came into the room with a huge hank of paper about this thick, and she said, you know what this is? I said, no. She said, it's your W-2 forms for this year. I had had 13 W-2 forms that year. You know when you start working for somebody and about 2 weeks in, they start blaming each other for having hired you? And they're really mad at each other. You got, no, you brought him in. No, I'm telling you, it was you. And, from working this 10 step and sponsoring other men and taking positive action and following the direction of a loving sponsor, both companies that I cooked for in sobriety asked me to go into business with. And that doesn't happen to a man who suffered from this spiritual sickness to the extent that I suffered. I'm very, very proud of that. sometime later, in my sobriety, I was online to get lunch, and this guy turned around, and he was buying a can of Colt 45 malt liquor, you know, with change and lint, and you know, he had been there for a week, and nobody wanted him there, and he turned around, and instead of in my best Bronx saying, what are you looking at, I said, how you doing? And he said, you don't know how I'm doing. Nobody knows how I'm doing except for the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So we went outside, and we talked. And we exchanged numbers, and that night he called me and said he wanted to be detoxed, and I called a guy with more time than me, and I went on my first real 12-step call. Some guys told us, take him down to County General and dump him off at the door. Don't go in with him so that they shouldn't see that he has a source of money or anything. Dump him off at the door and book. We went through the whole process with the guy. We went all the way up to the alcoholic ward. About halfway through, he turns to the guy I'm with, and he says, I feel like I'm dying. And the guy I'm with said, that's because you are. And I said, "That what an insensitive thing to say to this guy. What a cold, awful thing. Now, the guy's in a county facility. He's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break into a county facility. What's the guy supposed to say? You're just having a bad day? No, this isn't a bad day. This is what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. This is exactly what dying feels like." newcomers, you're going to hear some colossally stupid things about alcoholism. And one of the most colossal is, and you might hear it, you might not, people might say to you, oh, you're just using AA as another crutch. That's like telling a guy, well, you know, a diabetic, are you still using that insulin crutch? Mighty weak of you, fella. What it is it's a complete denial of the fact that we have an illness, that this is a disease, that this is a sickness. You've got to completely overlook that to view Alcoholics Anonymous as a crutch. But newcomer, if you want out of here, you're gonna find a way out of here. You know, there's nothing, there's no amount of logic, there's no amount of self-will, there's no amount of self-knowledge that I can help you out with that's gonna help you stay here. You know. So, if you stick around here any amount of time, any appreciable amount of time, you will see people come in here with bottoms that will make your hair stand on end. You will look at that man and that woman, and you will say he could never drink again. How could he or she ever drink again with what they've been through? They can't. But after a period of time, if they don't treat their alcoholism with the program of action outlined in our book, it'll become a bad day. It won't be their bottom anymore. It'll be a bad day, a bad week, a period of time where people were being particularly mean to them and thinking behind their back. And they will move on with the business of dying, and they will move out of these rooms, and they will move out of the grace of God, and they will perish. And, you know, I've heard at times people say, I choose to stay sober today. Well, that just doesn't work for me. I don't choose to stay sober today. I've lost the power of choice in drink. I don't have any power to choose. That's some kind of magnanimous choice I'm making. The men who I sponsored who are dead today, and there are some who have died, didn't wake up in the morning and choose to stay sober or choose to get loaded and die. They were spiritually unfit. They woke up. They were spiritually unfit. They got loaded and they died. You're going to hear a lot of numbers while you're in here. 1 in 7 billion make it, you know? The fact is our book contains numbers. In the forward to the second edition, it says 50% of us sober up at once, 25% sober up after a period of time, and of those who remain, 2 out of 3 return after a period of time. It says, of those who really try. Really try what? I'm assuming really try the work in that book. If you want to end a relationship with a newcomer, show them the work in that book. That'll end it quicker than anything I know of. If it's an annoying guy or a woman, show them the work in the book. Usually you'll never have to talk to them again. And if they stick around, the good news is they'll change. It has been my experience, you know, when somebody drinks, if you ask them what step they're working, they never say, you know, I was waking up every morning doing the first 3, I was in the middle of 4th, doing a lot of 12-step work and working the 11th step, and I drank. They always say, you know, I was just about to, I was on the brink of, I was going to call this guy any minute. They're always almost working a step. You know, another thing, you know, and it's just for me, you know, you hear, you know, I heard people talking about suicide when I came in. I'm not a suicide guy. I'm a murder guy. I vastly prefer your death to mine. And I figure if I kill all of you, there'll be no reason for me to commit suicide. And that, those were the guys who I tuned into, you know. And I heard people say, you know, I'm really, the person I'm most resentful at is me. And I said, nah, I hate me fine, but nothing compared to how much I hate you. I really hate you. I mean, I had plenty. When it was remorse, we were resentful at ourselves. But, man, I resented you much, much more than I resented me. And then the other thing I heard, you know, I heard people say, you know, referring to their brain in the third person, as if it was an unwanted alien, dashing about their house, planning their undoing. And I said, geez, that's how I feel now. I like to not feel that way. And the funny thing is our book says completely the opposite. It says in step 10, sanity will have been restored. In step 11, it says what used to be the occasional hunch or inspiration will have become a working part of the mind. Step 10 tells us that the alcohol problem will be removed. We won't even be fighting it. It'll be gone. We won't even be cocky. And then it talks about the correct use of self-will. So, any of that stuff that I felt uncomfortable with when I came in, I've never been able to find it in that book. Sometime after, this guy, I had this experience with this guy, one of the men who I sponsor called me up and said, look, don't talk to me about the steps anymore in the book and die. Leave me alone, man. He was sick of me and what I had to say, and he went and he stole a bunch of money and from people in the program, and he ripped off a car and he did an apartment. He was making me look pretty bad. And I wanted to sit down and explain a few things to him. And my sponsor said, you know, you've so frightfully abused your opinion of other people, you've lost the right to express it. Now, I'm not talking about standing up for yourself. One of my goals in AA is to take no crap and give none. Because every time I give some, I wind up taking some. And every time I wind up taking some, I wind up giving some. But to stand up for myself and tell you what I need without telling you what to do, without playing God, boy, I tell you, I like living that way. But what he was talking about was I no longer got to tell people where they stood in the universe. And I used to love to do that. But I had lost the right to do that. I had to sit down and I had to write, I am resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects my self-esteem, my pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and yes, sex. A little knock in the crotch there, a little ego blow. What are the defects of character in me that if God would remove, the resentment would be gone? Well, I am certainly unwilling to accept the fact that another child of God could be spiritually sick like me. And my sponsor gave me kind of template to find out if I was resentful at someone who was perhaps spiritually sick. He said, if they're one of the five A's, they're spiritually ill. You'll excuse my language. He said, if they're an alcoholic, an addict, an Al-Anon, an Alateen, or an asshole. He said which is the great watershed category. If you can't get them in the first four, you can always get them in the last one. So you're guaranteed success on some kind of level. And if they're one of the five A's, then you're resentful of someone who's perhaps spiritually sick. And again, you can't show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience you would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I am self-seeking. You know, and selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking, they're the same, but they're different. And when I ask God to take my life, I like to be as specific as I can be so I can get him into my life in a powerful way. You know, selfish is kind of wanting it all for me, and self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me, and self-centered is thinking it's all about me. They've all got their own little English. And here I'm like self-centered kind of because this is like all about me. The guy's the one who's suffering, not me. I'm a hypocrite. I've done the same things. I'm not trusting in God. And here's a new one. I'm spiritually prideful. I didn't get that till I came into AA and became a spiritual Goliath. How could a man comport himself thusly after being in contact with me? It's unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I did this inventory, and sometime after this, and this guy found out he had a fatal illness, and he called a city agency, and they said, all we can do is take you down to County General Hospital and dump you off at the door. And I knew that wasn't true because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he couldn't call anybody else he knew because he had burnt them out, and they had, I guess some of them had told him what they had thought of him. I was the only guy left he could call, and I got to be there for another man when he died when I couldn't be there for my father. And the amends to my father was made, and it was lifted from me, and my father came back into my life. And I could tell my kids about him. I could laugh about him. And instead of that horrible, cold, painful place that all it did was smart and all I did was wince when I thought about it, it was just fine. And I had my dad back again. If you're new here, I don't know what you've come in with. I don't know what your deal is. If you've strangled a puppy, we got a guy who's strangled two puppies. We're not going to play can you bottom this, but we can. One of the guys I sponsor got drunk, drove 17 miles the wrong way on the freeway, and drove off a 100-foot bridge. I was telling my kids about this. My 8-year-old at the time Jesse, and I said, and the guy was declared dead at the scene, and Jesse said, yeah, and dumb. My children have found an entire class of adult who's scared of them, which are the newcomers that come into my house. And when Jesse was 8, a guy walked into my house, and Jesse walked up to him and said, what step you working, pal? Four, and I said, he's 8, man, you know. We go over to my sponsor's house one night, my older boy, we go in, Don said to Mike, he said, oh, have you guys been playing video games? And Mike looks at him and goes, no, the obsession's been lifted. Now, I didn't have to read anything, buddy. The other day, my 14-year-old son looked at me and he said, you know, it's incredible, Dad. I have this powerful relationship with my God, and I don't go to synagogue, and my friend Eli goes to synagogue 3 times a week, and he doesn't know God. And he wasn't putting Eli down. He was struck with what happens in his life. We were on a ski lift, by the way, 7.5 years ago. I wasn't doing a lot of skiing. I was on a ski lift with my children this past winter, and it broke down, and we were way up, and Mike's frightened of heights, and I said, son, let's pray. And he said, Dad, I can't pray. I can't close my eyes. And I said, I don't think God's up there saying, you know, I'd give you what you want, but your eyes were open. And we started laughing together, and it was broken. What's happened in my house is a wholesale miracle. If you're new here, I'm not telling you that your family's going to come back together. I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous if I have my family or not, if my kids got well or not. That's not what I'm saying. I got to do my job if I'm living in a house or if I got to show people how to stay sober in a refrigerator box. I got to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know what God's will is for me. My God's will for me is to stay as free as possible of resentments, defects of character, sexual problems, and fears so I can do His work. He doesn't care where I'm working. My God doesn't care who I'm living with. He doesn't care. My God's not getting me parking spaces. Just my God. I do not have a God that's involved in parking at all. And I'm not putting down anybody who does. Please don't take my program as an indictment of yours. This is how I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You know, in the section on our sexual inventory, it says we write about what we should have done instead. What is the kind of man I'd want to be and never acted like? It says then in the bottom of the page, well, this is the way we shape a sound, ideal sex life that we ask God to help us walk toward. And at the bottom of the page, it says the right answers will come if we want them. It doesn't say the right answers will come if I like them. It says if I want them. My wife is my buddy, my lover, and my bride. We have a relationship today that is God has given back to us. As I told you, we don't work on our relationship anymore. Some years ago, we were sitting around a table with some other couples when we were still terribly ill, and we all had kids, and somebody started talking about what it's going to be like when kids start dating. And my wife said, you know, as long as my boys don't bring home boys. And somebody said, oh, you got a problem with gay men. And she said, no, I just don't want them making the same mistake I did. And she meant it. And what has happened is we've started working on ourselves and trying to bring a better person to the deal. And as long as I came to my marriage trying to figure out what I could take instead of what I could bring, I was doomed. As long as I came to my children, and I've been having a lot of great sadness with my children because my babies are gone. They're growing up. My younger son has begun the descent into puberty, and I feel a tremendous sadness, and I am the dad that I always wanted to be. You know, my kids fight to be the kid to go up the ski lift with me, and 7.5 years ago, they would have fought to be the kid not to go up the ski lift with me. I want to tell you, if you're new here, if you are not an alcoholic, if you don't have alcoholism, what is wrong with you? What's your problem, man? Consider the alternatives. This is the only text on a fatal illness that contains the sentence, "We absolutely insist on enjoying life." There's no book about cholera that says, "Cholera's a hoot." It's a scream. You'll meet other people with cholera. You'll have a great time. And then you'll meet people who just got cholera. That's the best. That's gonna just toast you. Stick around here long enough to get a diagnosis, just to find out if you have this strange mental twist that precedes the first drink, just to find out if you have this awful cancer of the soul that seems to blot out everything good in our lives, just to find out if you're an alcoholic, and if you are, welcome home. Thank you.